Yoga Vashishta, Part 18 by Swami Suryadevananda. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge, and known, seer, sight, and seen, doer, doing, and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. Last time, we discussed vicharana, or direct and steady observation of the mind, the second of the seven states or planes of wisdom of the great sage Vasishtha. Vicharana is not just steady observation, but while observing, empowering the inner intelligence to do what needs to be done as situations arise, and it is the very heart of spiritual progress and ascent. Lack of direct and steady observation thwarts or hinders spiritual progress and will stagnate or set back all efforts. These help towards direct and steady observation of the mind. Study, right conduct, concentration, and meditation. Company of the wise and the good. Knowing what is good, harmful, right, and wrong, and resolutely giving up all negative qualities like pride, envy, vanity, desires, and delusion. Today, let us look at the third of the seven states or planes of wisdom, Tanumanasa, or Tanumanasi. It is also known as the thinned and weakened mind. Towards this, we will discuss Tanumanasi lightly and then go into the factors that will help bring this about. And we will talk about assimilation, contact, and absorption, indifference to the world, a disciplined life away from society and all contacts, practicing the teachings that result in the right perception of what is, and the spirit of non-attachment, which increases in us as a result. Greetings. Let us start by examining or looking at this term, Tanumanasi, the thinned or the weakened mind, what it is, what it entails, and how to bring this about. But let us start on the other end first. How does this mind get thick in the first place? Because we have to stop the thickening while we start the thinning, and this process has to go on at the same time. It's futile to work on thinning the mind if on the back end or in our normal day-to-day activities, we are going to thicken it. So how does this mind get thicker? The mind gets thicker and more conditioned, which are the same thing. A thick mind is a more conditioned mind. When it feels that pleasure resulting from the sense objects or sense contact is experienced. And this sense contact is in regards to everything. People, conditioning, things, different conditions in life, across the spectrum. When the mind feels that pleasure resulting from sense contact is experienced, it gets thick. It registers that as a truth in itself, and it craves to want more and more, because it's the mind's habit to want joy, to want peace, to want all of this. But it gets misguided and off track with all of this. But these feelings that happiness and joy and pleasure is experienced by this. Simultaneously with this feeling that the mind registers within itself, that this brings happiness and this prevents happiness, attachment arises in the mind. Why? Naturally, the mind wants to preserve the experience. It wants to preserve the feeling of joy that it gets, however wrong the notion may be. If it feels that this gives pleasure, and if it feels this does not get pleasure, it wants to preserve that which it thinks gives pleasure, and it wants to prevent that which it thinks inhibits pleasure. And it registers the negative as an aversion or a dislike, and it registers the positive as a like. They are the same thing, and it registers in the same space of the mind. The same current, look, the exact same current is registered as one and as another by the same thing in the same thing. And that is why sages have said, and you will even read in the scriptures, that like and dislikes, fundamentally, they are the same. They are not very different, because the mechanism that makes this happen or perpetuates them is the same. The medium in which this mechanism works is the same. So we have to be careful in it. Our likes and dislikes may be misguided. We may think I like what is good and I don't like what is not good or not as good. But fundamentally, we fail to see it is the same thing happening within ourselves, not out there, but within ourselves. A simple example. Something like, say, one person does not like, the other person may like. Now, is this, ask yourself, is this the good or likability in the object, in the condition, in the person, or is it in the mind? You've heard it said, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. Well, my friends, this is true for everything across the board. It is in our mind, and it is not part of what's out there. This phenomenon is so widespread across our lives, so much, that it feels natural, and because of that, it goes unexamined. It goes unexamined, and the layer of conditioning thickens within ourselves. This results in craving and aversion. Craving for that which brings pleasure, and an aversion for all that we feel disallows, prevents, or inhibits this pleasure. It starts off harmlessly as a mild preference, but then it picks up steam and becomes strong currents of like and dislike. This itself, this mechanism which is designed for us to experience more joy and more peace, is fundamentally misguided, and it actually results as a destroyer of peace. The mechanism and the mind are the way of its working that is designed to promote peace or to bring peace, destroys peace. And how does it do that? By these twin currents of like and dislike. When likes increase, there is a craving. When dislikes increase, there is a sort of rejection. You can even say a sort of hatred and aversion. Now, my friends, in both these disallow peace. You may think, how does a craving disallow peace? It is a like, how does it disallow peace? Well, because you're not at peace when you have this craving working within you. I must get this, this must be had, or this must be prolonged. As long as this must and the mind is working towards it, scheming, planning, and all of that, it's not at peace. And this must not happen, this should not happen, I must prevent this. The mind is not at peace that way also. So the mechanism that is designed to further peace disallows peace. This is something we have to see very clearly if we want to override this mechanism. This mechanism is fueled by conditioning, and it can be overridden by the mind that is aware of this conditioning. Because not only does conditioning exist, but we are also aware of conditioning every step of the way. And this is a very important point. Let things be there. There may be sorrow, there may be joy, there may be all of that in our lives. But we are aware of that. Now, where is our center of gravity? Is our center of gravity, or the feeling of I, anchored to that which likes and dislikes? Or is it anchored to that which is aware? If it shifts to that which is aware, my friends, it will weaken the entire mechanism of likes and dislikes. See, my friends, there is absolutely nothing wrong with the simple pleasures that come in life, that come by very naturally, that do not require this pursuit and avoidance, which changes to likes and dislikes. We have to see this very clearly. The problem is not in the simple pleasures that come in life. The problem is in the pursuit and the avoidance, the like and dislikes, which result into pursuit and avoidance. That is the stress in our lives. The stress is not the other things. The simple joys will come naturally. Let them come. You need not pursue them. Why should we pursue them? Then you might think, if I don't pursue them, how do I promote my joy? How do I keep joy active in our life? My friends, we spoke about this the last time and earlier too. Why isn't there joy in doing what needs to be done wholeheartedly? Wholeheartedness itself is joy. When we are whole, we are joyful. And we experience that every night in deep sleep. We become whole. All the rays of the mind come together, and there's great joy. We love it when we've had a good night's sleep. We wake up and say, I feel rested. I feel good. So, my friends, all this tells us that we've got to make a change within ourselves, not of all the things that are out there, but within ourselves, very fundamentally, we disallow the joy we value and seek most of all. And we tend to allow that which disrupts this peace. And when we see this very clearly, we can go about making a change towards this. When we see this clearly, a feeling of disinterestedness in the pleasure of the senses arises in one. And this gives rise to non-attachment. Till this feeling of disinterestedness arises within us, non-attachment does not happen. As long as we have attachments towards this, we also have an aversion towards that, and this cycle of like and dislikes continues. When that cycle continues, we block our own peace. The cycle we've made to promote peace disallows peace. We've got to see this very clearly. Now, a word about disinterestedness, my friends. Disinterestedness in pursuit and avoidance as a means to pleasure is wisdom. Disinterestedness does not mean an aversion. We are simply no longer enamored or thrilled by the mind that says, this is joy, let's run after it. Or this is non-joy, let's avoid it. So when we are not interested in that, joy is experienced naturally. We are not interested in joy that comes as a result of something, because when the conditions are opposed to it, we experience non-joy or a vacuum or even aversion. We don't want a joy that comes today and that is not going to be there tomorrow or the next moment. What good is that? What good is being a yo-yo to things at all? So this disinterestedness is just not being enamored by the mind's habitual working. And until that arises in us, non-attachment doesn't happen. Non-attachment is letting go of this mechanism of likes and dislikes at its basic level. Non-attachment, whether it be to people, conditions, or things, is not an aversion to things. We've got to see this clearly. Sometimes people think that non-attachment means you become cold and clammy. Not at all. Not at all, my friends. Far from that. Non-attachment simply means we are no longer enamored that our joy comes from them. Our joy comes from being. And if we are good to others, to people, to conditions, if we work good in our lives, work hard in our lives, why wouldn't joy come from that? Why should joy come as a result of something? See, my friends, effort is in our hands. Result is not. Result is shaped by many things. It may turn out this way, it may not turn out this way. As long as we anchor our happiness and our success with result, we are going to go up and down with these waves of likes and dislikes. These are the twin currents that drive that ocean as long as we go that way. But when we rewire ourselves and anchor our happiness and our joy to doing, which is always in our hands, no one can prevent you, no one and no condition can prevent you from doing something very well, wholeheartedly, with all of your heart and mind. Who can prevent you from doing that? What can prevent you from doing that? Neither fate, nor destiny, nor karma, nor anything can prevent you from being good and doing good in its fullest sense every step of the way. Now, why can't that be seen as joyful? Why is that not joyful? Why is that not joy itself, doing something wholeheartedly? Think back, my friends, at all the times that you've done something wholeheartedly and you felt good. Whether it be something that you've done as a chore, in your work, or even in your family life, it doesn't matter where. Wholeheartedness itself is joy. So there is a big difference, my friends. Now, a second thing that we want to talk about, we're really talking about this thing called pursuit of pleasure. Not of avoiding pleasure, but the pursuit of pleasure. Because pursuit itself is unhappiness, is instability. When you run after something, you're out of breath. And when we are chasing that which we think is going to promote happiness, at that moment also, we are out of the breath of happiness. We don't have, therefore we want. Why do you pursue? You pursue because it's not there, or because you want more. It's not enough. So at that moment, there has to be a little bit of vacuum or unhappiness felt, which is why we pursue things. But when happiness is anchored to doing and being rather than result, this whole mechanism of pursuit falls apart. And when it falls apart, my friends, tremendous joy is experienced. Pursuit is not pleasure, and it may not result in pleasure. See this very, very clearly, and you will be inspired to let it go. Pursuit and avoidance energizes the likes and dislikes in the mind, and these become cravings and aversions, which completely inhibit joy, natural joy, from being experienced. So in giving up these inner ties that bind, the mind's likes and dislikes are weakened. This is what it comes down to fundamentally. When the likes and dislikes are weakened, the mind becomes thinner. It becomes more subtle. It becomes transparent, or it becomes tanumanas. Tanumanas is a thinned or weakened or more transparent mind. This, my friends, is the third state of the seven states or planes of wisdom of Vasishtha. It is also called non-attachment or freedom. Now, let us change or shift gears and go about simple ways to bring this about, tanumanas, by first looking at what are or how is tanumanas characterized by. We start with the first of few points that we've laid out for ourselves and talk about assimilation, contact, and absorption. Let us just break it down a little bit more over this brief title that we put together. One assimilates the teachings of the scriptures, lives with the masters, and listens to their teachings. And let us look at this in a more fundamental way on how we can practice it practically. Assimilation, my friends, is different from what is known, what we call, or what this term called internalizing, that we hear so much about nowadays. Internalizing a teaching is having the teaching within, ready to use, perhaps in our hip pocket, but it stays as a teaching within our hip pocket. It stays there, and we stay who we are. There is no connection between the two of them. It's sort of like a weapon that we carry within us, or a trick that we have within us, and that is internalizing, keeping it within. We keep a lot of buzzwords and little cliches and things internalized so that we can pull it off from time to time and talk about it or impress others. But we stay the same fundamentally. There is a difference between this thing called internalizing and assimilation. Assimilation is different, my friend. Here in assimilation, the word becomes flesh. The teaching starts acting out in our life. It's not something that is used here and there as we go along. Just like if you've heard about maybe a quote or an inspiring line, and we come into conversation and we can use that. But we use that, we may not be practicing it, we may not be living it, but we can talk about it. We can brandish it like a weapon or something to impress people here. And people may say, oh wow, wonderful, he's a wise person or well-read or whatever. But it may be quite different on what that person is fundamentally in his own nature. So this thing called internalizing is just having it in, to brandish, to show off, to put here and there and talk about here and there. But fundamentally, at a very basic level, the person stays the same. Matter of fact, the vanity of the person probably increases. Assimilation is very different. When we come upon these truths, assimilating is not internalizing it, but word becoming flesh, or the teaching becoming who we are, or in a more practical sense, acting out or living the teaching. The practice of the teaching in our day-to-day life, naturally and ongoing, is assimilation. The teaching, the word, becomes flesh. So assimilation is very different from the so-called internalizing, so to say. It has to be, teachings have to be empowered. Teachings have to be unrestricted. Teachings have to be unhindered. Remember these three: empowered, unrestricted, and unhindered, across the entire spectrum of our life. Not just here or there, or in a little satsang group, or among friends when we are talking about the holy, holy stuff. It's easy at that time to talk about all this stuff, but it's very different to practice this fundamentally, not just all the time, but even in the moments we are alone, even in the moments that we are by ourselves. Let thoughts or notions arise in the mind, to simply be aware of them and dismiss them by realizing that you are not them, you are that which is aware of them. So this has to be empowered, unrestricted, and unhindered across the entire spectrum of our life. For assimilation, our teaching or our study has to be much more than a daily activity. I know study has been pushed in all the religions and all of that. One has to study towards anything if one wants to learn anything. But study for something and study for your own self are a little bit different out here too. Study, my friends, becomes a way of feeding the soul's hunger to merge in its source. We have to actually be feeling that we want this here and now. And when we come upon these golden nuggets, that has to be not internalized, but it has to be actualized. This is a very big difference. Actualizing means the word becomes flesh. And at the moment of study, we are thinking about, how do we practice this? I must practice this now. I will practice this now. At that moment, there is immediate change taking place while we study. We are not just studying about something, but while studying, we are making changes to ourselves at a very grassroots, fundamental, root level. This time where study, the activity, is empowered to make changes at a fundamental level to who we are. Not, I must practice this once in a while, or I must do this, or it's a good thing, or people will be impressed. But this now, when this is felt deeply in our soul, study becomes a way of feeding the soul's hunger. All the missteps that have been made are corrected right there in the hours of study. One does not merely study, but through study, there is an immediate and irreversible change in one's thinking and the way one feels about things at a deeper level. One ponders about how to practice this, how to practice these teachings, not just in our spiritual life, but across the board, in our complete life, because it's a change in who we are at a fundamental level. Along with that, one also considers all that is not conducive, all that inhibits, or all that blocks self-knowledge, and immediately uproots them root and branch. These things prevent or disallow this which I am seeking, and no more. That's it. So the resolve that is needed in study, the empowerment that is needed in study, is very different from this casual browsing that happens. And this is why, my friends, we've talked over earlier that this casualness has to come out of our life. I'm not talking about getting too serious, but this casualness causes a lackadaisical attitude, and which is the mind is distracted. We try to do too many things. This thing that doesn't work called multiple tasking and all of this other these other things, buzzwords that the have become so common nowadays. They are no good, my friends, because they really corrupt the mind's wholeness and fullness, and at a fundamental level, they block our own peace. They don't deliver anything at all. So when you do one thing that is well, with all of your heart, with all of your mind, all of us comes together. When all of us comes together and joy is experienced by doing, we're always joyful. And we're always doing something or the other. So we find a way to keep our joy perpetual, steady. And this is a very important thing. We have to also prevent all these things and uproot these things that prevent and disallow peace, joy, and harmony in our lives. Now, it is rare that one can bring about this total transformation within without contact with others that have also done so. Because habit is such a strong thing, my friends. You do it for a little while, then when you come in contact with other people, and we feel if I do it this way, it's going to rub them wrong or this like that, or they might not take it, or what if, and we give in. How do we make this being good and doing good a steady current in our life? So there must be contact in some way with people, or if it's not directly with people that have realized, indirectly with their teachings. And that is found in the scriptures, and it is available so commonly today. But we have to seek this actively. And having this company or contact with the masters or their teachings, the people that have actually done so, invigorates and strengthens our own resolve. So towards this, one seeks the company of the masters and listens to their teachings. And if one does not have active company of the masters, well, their teachings are available to you. And you can keep company, dedicated company with their teachings, which is sort of indirect company. And in those hours that we make regular contact in our life, there can be and there should be this transformation that we are talking about. When we have this regular contact, what was studied in the scripture meets practical experience, and this gives tremendous momentum towards our practice. We must be able to have this catalyst. It is this which is the pivot that breaks the back of habit. Not only hope, but directly seeing that the way is not only possible and plausible, but the way is very clear. This has to be seen. Friends, we now come to the second major point towards Tanumanasa that we've been talking about, which is an indifference to the world, a disciplined life, away from society and all contacts. Now, I know some of you may be sitting and thinking, this is not possible. But let us break it down into understanding what this is all about so that you can temper it to the best way that you feel in your life. Having studied and read, one becomes steady in the inner journey because one realizes no more of this. And these changes are inculcated or made to happen then and there. When this happens, one becomes indifferent to the outer world. Indifferent to the outer world, my friends, does not mean aversion or hatred to the outer world. Indifferent. This is a very important word in yoga, especially in the Yoga Vashishta. What is indifference? But let us break it down. What is difference? This is different from that. This is a trick of the mind, my friends, difference. There is no difference fundamentally in any substance at all, because all the likability and unlikability of all substances is not in the substance. It is in our mind. You've heard it said, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. Some person may like something, some other person may not like it. I ask you, is it in the thing or is it in the mind that beholds it? It's in the mind that beholds it. So this indifference is needed to make the mind steady. Conditioning works through difference. This is good, this is not good. This promotes joy, this disallows joy. All of that is happening around, and who made this choice? Did the condition make the choice? No, we made the choice. This is not good. And when this comes across our lives, we say not good, not good. Who is experiencing not good? We are. Who made that term? And who made that connection that this is not good? We did. So we are experiencing what we did. It's really not very difficult, my friends. But it's a trick of the mind that we are never allowed to see this. So this indifference means it doesn't make a difference how things are. I am concerned with how I should be, and I am concerned with this very much. I should be good, and I should do good. Let the world be what it is. It's not a hatred for the world, but you change the world by changing yourself. A whole ocean can be changed if the quality of one drop of water is changed very, very fundamentally in a concentrated manner. So if you want to change anything outside, if you want to change anything at all, change yourself. We've heard it said, a wise man once said, be the change that you want to see. It comes down to this. So my friends, it doesn't mean that one abhors or one hates the world, but one is not lured. The seeker is not lured or tempted by that which it thinks promotes joy or feels promote joy, and one is not averted to that which it thinks or feels disallows joy. The thinking and feeling is done by us. So we make the rules, and then we say, oh my. Friends, look at this. Just look at all of this. So we are not complaining about anything out there, but we are talking about the unwatched ways of the mind. We are talking about how we disallow joy and happiness in our own life, though not deliberately, but how we do it mistakenly, and how we can change that, and how we can make our life more joyful. So joy is not experienced by this wantonness or carelessness or callousness. Joy is actually experienced by discipline, a disciplined life. And you may think, oh my, a disciplined life, there he goes again. We're talking about structure, we're talking about this, we're talking about that. I can no longer do things as I want, when I want, but that as I want, when I want, what I want is driven by the wantonness of the mind, the waywardness of the mind, by conditioning, by something that is not knowledgeable, by ignorance. When ignorance drives that, the result cannot be good and lasting. We have to understand this very clearly. So discipline comes from the very root word to be a disciple, to be a student of life. Discipline. When we see that this disallows and this is not necessarily good, because we have examined life, been a student of life, that fire, that wisdom now says, not this, this instead. That working in our life is discipline working in our life. Discipline is the pivot that makes teachings come alive within. It remembers the teachings and it knows this disallows, it must be done this way. Joy must be experienced from doing and being rather than from what comes, because what comes is not in my control. So disciplined life, my friends, is not a life of punishment and self-denial, but of avoidance of what is not good and lasting for what is indeed good and durable or lasting. As in any big change in anything, my friends, the pull of habit is so strong, and to prevent backsliding or falling back into the grip of habit, one sets up a structure for managing one's own self, one's own activities, and one's own attitude in life. This structure, with a system of self-accountability, which we have talked about earlier, is the very basis to prevent slipping into the grip of habit. And it is essential to move forward. When you want to move forward, you've got to make sure that you are not going to fall back. If we don't have that mechanism, moving forward is going to be hindered. Moving forward is not going to be plausible. You know this, my friends. If you want to save money, you've got to prevent all of that by which money can be squandered aimlessly, uselessly. Until we have that discipline within us, we can make money, but we're going to lose money. So it's the same way in spiritual life also. Real change is very difficult when living among, now we're going to talk about a topic that is slightly opposed to the current of thought nowadays, but we have to talk about it nonetheless because it's at the core of teachings and change. Real change is very difficult while still living amidst kith and kin as friends and friends with all people that were connected to the old way of doing things. It is very difficult because that old group, however close they might be, will insist on the old you. The new you is trying to break out of the old skin, and the old group is going to insist on the old you, which you have to gradually grow out of or go beyond. So when we have this insistence, we have added another layer of difficulty in our life. We want to do this. We have the force of habit, and we have the pressure from all those that were connected to the old force of habit, be they kith and kin or friends or co-workers or whatever, that will also insist on perpetuating the way things were. So we are faced with this pressure in our mind. What do? Sometimes we become superfluous. oh, I'll just spend some time to keep that going, and I'll just do it though I don't mean it anymore. My friends, we can't do that, because when we do things that we don't mean, we become superfluous. And then at a given point, we do our teachings, and this wave comes into our teachings also, where we do things, we meditate and all of that, but we don't mean it. We study it and say, oh, wonderful, but we don't mean it. So we have to bring this thing called sincerity into our life thoroughly. Change, all change initially is a novelty, but this wears off gradually. When you come to the spiritual life and you have to actually walk the path, you have to walk the talk, at that point, the novelty wears off, because we come into conflict. It wears off within, and it wears off with others. Our turn in the spiritual path may be seen initially by others as, oh, wonderful, he's doing something. But when what you're doing is going to stand opposed to the way things are, the arrangement of things, or the way people expect them to be, it is not going to be accepted, my friends. Understand this in a very fundamental way, that this clash is going to come about, and it must come about. It's not wrong. I'm not criticizing any. It must come about, so we stand our ground. You feel the conviction of what is right, and you do what is right. Let things fall as they will. Let things be just as they will. We do not intend to do this or to disrupt anything. But to thine own self be true. That's what the poet said. A wonderful line. When we are true to ourselves, things may shake up. They may go this way. There may be rejection. There may be all of that. But water seeks its own level. And eventually, things are going to level out. Everything is there to test our faith, our conviction, and our deep-rootedness within ourselves. And it is there to help that. Let this turbulence be there at one level. It will, and it must, and it will level out once again. So if we try to always cosmetically keep things in balance, so to say, a cleverness comes into our mind, a clever type of attitude. In Hindi, they call this, Hindi and English, a combination of them, they call this the Babu mentality. A Babu mentality is, in English, called slick. One realizes to do what seems to be acceptable on the outer, or to be hypocritical or superfluous. Swami Shivananda has said that we don't need a Babu mentality or this slick mentality. We need a sadhu mentality. A sadhu is a simple person. Sadhu comes from the root word sadhu, not just a monk, but a sadhu is a simple person. It comes from the root word sadharan. Sadharan means simple at its very root, a simple person. And what is simpler than being true to yourself, to one value that we are anchored to? That is simplicity. Simplicity is one. So, to prevent all these difficult situations from coming around, it is best to be free from all contact, unless necessary for some reason, because you don't do this by breaking that, but you start this by making new contact with everything and everyone that may be conducive to your aspiration. There is a lot of good contacts, a lot of good friends, a lot of good everything that comes about. So we don't break with anything. We simply be true to ourselves. And in being true to ourselves, things that are not directly connected with who you are at a very fundamental level tend to fall away. Naturally, let them fall away. The things, only when you let them fall away, we welcome all that is truly supportive of our aspiration. And this is a very big fundamental step. My friends, ponder on the basis of what we have talked about, and you will come to understand some of the changes that we may think are foreboding, but actually for our highest good. Friends, we now come to the third point under this Tanumanasi which we have laid out for ourselves. Practicing the teaching results in right perception. And we have been talking about this, but I'd like to go just a little bit deeper into this. Sincerity in study is interest in self-change. We are not studying about anything, even when we study a scripture, but through the scripture, we are studying ourselves. The seeker is interested in self-change continually. The only thing, this all that prevents self-knowledge must be let go, and all that promotes self-knowledge must be enhanced or must be practiced. And this change goes on continually. We are not interested in just knowing about some topic. We are interested in directly knowing who we are by self or by direct experience. That is the only quest. So how do I be? How do I live? How do I function? So that the I changes so drastically, and what hinders the true I is let go, so that the true I may be seen in all of its glory. In spiritual life, you, your true nature, is the only topic. There is no other topic. Not studying this, not studying that, not studying what happened thousands of years ago. None of that stuff. None of that. Self-knowledge. Self-knowledge not to become some kind of scholar, to become some kind of learning person, but knowing directly who we are in a very fundamental and direct way, by direct experience, to know who we are truly. You may think, well, I know who I am, and we've discussed this before. But who is it that is aware of that, that you are experiencing at that moment? Do we know that at its very fundamental level? So you are learning about yourself, and you feel a strong urge to burst out of this cage of habit into the infinity of your true nature. This means that you are to grow into the likeness of your aspiration. All that we read about that is good, that is all of that, to grow into that, to become that. The word has to become flesh. We have to melt into our own aspiration. This melting into our aspiration is the practice of teaching. When you grow into the teaching, at once, at the same time, you leave habit behind. See, my friends, I wonder if you've ever seen a snake. It changes its skin every so often, entire skin. It's called, the old skin is called a slough. The snake withers around and comes to a rock or to a tree, and it brushes itself against that tree again and again and again. Why? To let go of its old skin, to sort of peel it backwards. Why? Because its new skin has already grown beneath the old skin. So when it slithers back and forth against a rock or against a tree, it looks painful, but it's shaking away that old slough, and that old skin is sort of let go as a dead skin. And what reveals is beautiful, shiny new skin. It sheds its skin completely, totally. And it's new, its entire skin is new from end to end. It's a very beautiful thing. Well, we're going to do something just like that, to shake away the I, the habitual I, which has not done anything for our happiness and our joy. Matter of fact, it's disallowed it. It has not been durable. It has not delivered the goods. For that which is already there, resident within us, that does deliver. And this shaking through is the journey of spiritual life. So towards all this, it is most helpful to do good actions and deeds. First, initially, before making friends and changing friends and all of that, with good people, all of that, start that, yes. But the very first thing that we can start right where we are is to make good friends with good actions and good deeds. Let these be your steady friends. You already have them. You need not go any place to find these two guys. These guys are very close to you. I will make good actions and good deeds my good friends. They are steady and they are reliable. And what do we like to do with good friends, my friends? We like to hang out with them, do we not? We like to keep their company, do we not? Okay, so we keep company of good deeds, good thoughts, good deeds, good action. And what do we do anytime something not so good pops up in the heart and mind? Because it does. Simply say, not this, this instead, and continue on course. That's it. This requires ongoing vigilance, which we have talked about earlier or before. So we have to learn to do good, not for any other reason, but because it needs to be done. This way we dismantle this mechanism of reason in our life, that this is in my interest, this is not in my interest, this will deliver more goods, that way I will make more, or all of that mechanism, my friends, needs to be junked. Just got rid of. All of that is just a bad habit that does not deliver. This is a way to understand the practice of goodness. Goodness in you must do the good deeds till goodness increases and fills our being completely. This is how we understand goodness. We've been talking about it. But let us talk about it in a very fundamental way. What is it? Goodness in you must do good. Non-good cannot do good. Sometimes, let me give you an example of this. It looks or sounds too philosophical. We see something and we feel, if I do it in this manner that looks good or feels good, they will be impressed. So I'm not good at my core, but I put on an act. Why? Because that act will impress people and I will get what I need. I will get what I need, and so I will do what looks good to get what I need. Is there any practice of goodness in that? Or are we just increasing our vanity and all of this conditioning and this hypocrisy and duality within ourselves? This is called, people call being diplomatic in life and being all of that. My friends, it's not a good thing. It makes you hypocritical. It makes you insincere. It makes you incapable of leading a spiritual life in its true sense, of even leading a fulfilling or a true life. It makes you incapable of being true to yourself. This superfluousness, my friends, is not good. So, goodness must do good deeds. When we do good deeds, it also increases goodness in us. It must be unconditional. Not being good or doing good because we earn the praise of people or the recognition of people, because goodness is its own reward. The buck stops here. I will do good because goodness has value in itself. When we give goodness value in itself, my friends, real change takes place at a very fundamental level. The reasons for everything is the deception in all things. This has to be taken out of the equation completely, my friends. More so in today's times, where all this political correctness promotes tremendous hypocrisy. Tremendous hypocrisy. So much so that it seems normal and natural. But we have to change back that tide of time within ourselves, because we know it is a better thing to do. This will squeeze out all that is not good when we make this resolve that goodness must do the good deeds in our life till goodness increases in our life. Goodness has its own value. We are not good because of 1, 2, and 3, or A, B, and C. Goodness has its own value. The buck stops there. This will squeeze out all that is not good, just like we squeeze out the last bit of toothpaste from a tube of toothpaste. Here too, my friends, It's difficult to truly practice in familiar environments because familiar or known or habitual or old environments will insist on habitual ways. So we come into conflict. We want to do good and we want to practice all of this, but this stands at odds with habitual ways. We don't want to let go of that and we want to do this. So it seems, my friends, that we are tied. It's a no-win situation. We do this sometime and we do that sometime. We please the soul, we please the self sometime, and we please who we choose to hang out with or whatever else the rest of the time. And in that struggle, my friends, we never really please the self because we don't take a stand. We're wishy-washy, little bit this way, little bit that way. Where are we going in life if a boat goes this direction for a little while, that direction for a little while? Is it ever going to get any place, my friends? Ask yourself this. So, the initial surface acceptance among friends, family, and all of that will soon give way to total rejection. Now, I'm not being doom and gloom about something or critical about anything, but I'm just telling you the force of habit will swell up as non-acceptance when it feels threatened. Because habit must perpetuate itself. That's why it's called habit. We are talking about the fundamental basics of the principle of this thing called habit. Habit must perpetuate itself. And anything that stands in the way of habit must be done away with. This is the current of habit. This is the force of habit and of those that are enslaved with habit. They also think like that. I'm not being critical about things, my friends, but we have to understand it so we know how to properly deal with it. So the bottom line is, all this makes it difficult to plunge very deep within, and there is constant inner conflict. The reason our practice does not anchor or take root is because we don't resolve these issues while we are practicing. We are practicing, but we have a lot of buts in our life. Just ask yourself, my friends, if this is true or not. I'd like to practice, I'd like to do all of this, but we are not resolving that. We don't give in to things wholeheartedly. Well, if I do things wholeheartedly, I'll be cut off from everything and everyone. We are not talking of being cut off from anything and everyone. We are just talking about doing things wholeheartedly, doing what we feel is good, doing what we feel is right. If something has to happen, change has to happen, let it happen. But I value what I'm seeking more than any change that might come about. Is that selfish to aspire to be good and to be true? Is it? Ask yourself this. So all of this is more important today than ever before, because in today's times, my friends, especially with all of this connectivity that we have today, real-time talk, touch, all of that, people want to know, and we don't get time to think things deeply because the pressure to know and respond and conform and accept and convey our acceptance or communicate is instant, real time, now. So the pressure is so hard now, we don't get the time and space to think and figure things out and respond in time as was earlier. This is why understanding is so important. And you may be thinking, my friends, we've been talking about theory and all of this. And why is it also important? Because the times have changed and we have to realize that the currents that we have or we might be dealing with are much closer and much stronger than they've ever been before in history. So the difficulty in progress is very simple. It's one word, backsliding, falling back into the grip of habit. And hence one has to have three things: tremendous clarity in our heart, what is desirable, what is good, what is sought, inner conviction that I will do this, inner conviction to stay the course, and readiness or a willingness wholeheartedly, not grudgingly, to let the outer take its own course. If you want the inner to run deep, you have to let the outer take its own course. These two, my friends, will clash through time and in life. They're designed to do that, not to punish you. They're designed to strengthen resolve. Well, if the boat wants to sail out into the open seas, my friend, it has to let go of its mooring, its anchoring to the dock. As long as the boat wants to be anchored too, and it wants to sail out too, is that going to happen, my friends? Is that possible? Is that realistic? Ask yourself this. So three things. Tremendous clarity, for which we have our study, our company of the wise, all of that, our satsang, all of that. Inner conviction. Wholeheartedness, which is wholeheartedness. And the readiness and willingness, enthusiastic readiness. Let the outer take its own course. You cannot plunge deeply within if you are also concerned deeply about the outer. These two things, my friends, work in different dimensions. Inner progress will come at odds, or may look to come at odds, with outer movement or the arrangement of things. Let things be as they are and as they will be. They've always been that way. You cannot change them. Things are going to go their own course, but you can change your course. To thine own self, be true. You can change your course. And if you become a pilot of your ship and change your own course, the outer will wobble. It'll go this way and that way. And eventually, my friends, I can assure you that the outer will fall into perspective with the inner. The inner will be so deeply rooted that the outer will start to fall in line with it. Till this rooting takes place, there is conflict. We have to be strong enough to weather all of this to be able to sail out on the open seas and in the ocean. So, with all this sure footing, the three of these things is the sure footing that we have been talking about. Tremendous clarity, inner conviction, readiness and willingness enthusiastically to let the outer take its own course. This is the sure footing that one needs as we move out into the open spiritual seas. This, coupled with relentless perseverance, I must do, I will do till the end, and God's grace, with the three of these things, one attains right perception of what is. We now come to this topic, the spirit of non-attachment increasing. And we're going to look into it a little bit deeper. My friends, the reason we talk about this and go into this a little bit more, it was we have to connect the teachings of the scripture, the great scripture, Vashishta, with our day-to-day lives in a very practical way. So it cannot be just another theory or something we've heard about, but can this be practiced? Can this be actualized? And is it of any value to me to begin with? We have to look at this. And this is why we are going into this in this sort of manner. I'm gripping the teaching, the main points in one manner, and we are talking about our day-to-day lives and practical things till we can make a bridge. What good is all of the teachings, reciting them, chanting them, all of that, if we are not going to practice them, if we are not going to live them, if the word's not going to become flesh? There is so much talk about religion and the high ground, and there is a behavior and action that is quite contrary, my friends. Isn't this common in our lives? Don't we see this in life all across the board? Well, it may be. We're not complaining about anything, but we are looking at things and making fundamental change within ourselves so that we don't get caught up in that current. We stay on the path of what is good. Non-attachment does not mean that one becomes cold and clammy or that one does not care. It's actually quite the opposite. Absolutely the opposite. Now just think about it. All the warm talk that you might have, the warm and fuzzy talk that people get so caught up in nowadays, how much of it is really sincere? How much of it is really sincere? You may say things so dramatically that express an interest. Just like that book that came out a long time back, How to Win Friends and Influence People. That is all a book of manipulation. How to do things and say things to get what you want. And if that is not manipulation, my friends, because what you want is at the basis of it, no matter what is outside or what is portrayed outside. So all this warm talk, how much of it is really sincere? So this spirit of non-attachment promotes this sense of sincerity. A shrewd and calculating mind may be working overtime while all the pleasantries and warm talk may be exchanged. I'm merely suggesting, my friends, not being critical, but merely suggesting that we need to go beyond the convenient face of the outer to even understand what non-attachment is. We have to go beyond theology. We have to go beyond differences in doctrine. We have to go even beyond all of the things in religion, because all of them can interfere. We have to look at it in a very fundamental and practical way. Without being critical of anything, we have to just look at it. Why? Because we want to know. This wanting to know has to be deeper than wanting to know, even according to my school of belief or my religion. Not according to anything. To want to know things fundamentally. Non-attachment is a very deep field. Let us look at the high end of it and then work our way backwards. The very high end of it, sort of philosophically, and work our way backwards. If God is all, then all must be God at its very fundamental and root level. Somehow we have to ask ourselves, if God is not all, that is God, and here I am. Who controls this real estate or space in between? Some other person? Then maybe he's bigger than God. Who controls that space? If God controls all the space, then what is the difference and spatial segregation between me, God? You may call God the absolute, the truth, or anything else, but God is a simple way for the absolute. The one, second to one, none exists. That we call God lovingly. You may call anything else after that, my friends, perfectly acceptable. But what we mean is the same thing. There's a lot of talk about this and that and my religion, all of this conflict nowadays, my friends, though it all points to the same thing, there is all this squabble because of all this outer labeling. We don't concern ourselves with that. So who, if God is all, where does the difference arise? All forms and appearance must be God, as God is the only reality. So in our practice, in our final approach, both on in life and on the mat, this truth, that the truth is one, God is all is God, has to be emblazoned in our heart. If this is in our heart, if all is in our heart, then non-attachment happens. We get attached to this, but we also get non-attached, disattached, or separated from that. We get attached to that which we like, and automatically a little bit of aversion to what we don't like. See, this whole mechanism is perpetuated by likes and dislikes. And likes and dislikes functions through attachment and aversion. Non-attachment is breaking the grip of all of this at its fundamental or root level. How do we get non-attached? By being attached to this truth or this fact till it is experienced, even in theory, that one alone exists. God alone is. The truth is one, God is one, the wise refer to it as many. These are the teachings that we have heard in the scriptures, my friend. But what good is it if we don't practice it? So, this acceptance in our heart that God is all and all must be God. Yes, there is a world. Yes, there is something out there. Yes, there is a way of doing business and all of this and all of that. But at its fundamental level, nothing conflicts with this understanding. The practice of this understanding is bringing the teaching into life. And it is also a melting or surrendering that is inside. And this surrender inside, the acceptance of the omnipresence of God, is at once self-surrender. This requires tremendous inner courage, fortitude, faith, and unrelenting perseverance. It's not going to happen little by little, my friends, and there's no need for that. But can we practice that little by little and bring our spirituality and our religion and our deep conviction into life? Not by going and carrying a book around and lecturing to other people or anything like that, but at its very fundamental basis, religion talks about goodness. Can we bring the practice of goodness into life, not to impress others, but because goodness has its own value? That's it. So it's not easy, and the masters have laid out two forms of non-attachment, ordinary and what they call superior, not because of anything else, but because we can understand it clearly. The difference between these two is qualitative. It is qualitative in what it is, but it's also qualitative because of how much conviction or heart we can muster. We are not able to rise to that occasion of that superior non-attachment immediately because of many factors. The sages don't knock that. They say, okay, rise to this first level and then eventually to that level. Ordinary non-attachment, when sustained and fueled by inner discipline and unrelenting love for God, it develops or it bursts into this thing that we call superior non-attachment. Let's look at it a little bit more to understand what this ordinary non-attachment and superior non-attachment is. One who has not directly realized the truth has to walk the path of this ordinary non-attachment. It is a sort of non-attachment till we have realized the truth of oneness on our own. Only then can we have the superior non-attachment based on direct realization. Now that, my friends, is in the case of very, very few. In the most of us, we have to start off with practicing the teachings of the great ones till that becomes our own experience. So the seeker feels continuously within himself, I am not the experiencer or doer. I have nothing to do with anyone in particular or nor has anyone or anything to do with me. This doesn't mean we hate things, but at a fundamental level, to let go of the false attachment that we have for my and mine, my relatives, my people, my things. The only way we can let go, I have nothing to do with it. They are not yours, my friends. Relatives, this, that, they are not yours. The Yoga Vashishtha brings this out in a very beautiful story that we won't go into, where a wife becomes the teacher of the husband and comes in a garb. The husband goes to the forest to practice, but he still holds on to a lot of his vanity and doesn't let go. He lets go of a lot of things. He was a king. He lets go of that, his kingdom. He walks away from everything, but he doesn't let go of other things that truly hinder him. And the wife knows that he is not going to listen to me. She was a realized seeker. They both had high spiritual aspirations. but she moved towards realizing it. He sort of didn't make that step. So he moved cosmetically into the forest and gets away from things and asks her to rule his kingdom as queen. She realizes that he's still not making adjustments at a fundamental level. But she also knows if I go to him as me, he's going to reject me, because we don't really want to hear things from people that are close to us, my friends, because those bonds interfere. No matter how much you love them, we really don't take things of value, deep things, from people with whom we are wired differently. All this is brought out beautifully in the Yoga Vasishtha. Great scripture. I really recommend you read it. So she puts on another garb as a mendicant, as a sort of ascetic, and comes over and gradually leads him to a state of what true renunciation is by all the false renunciations. I've renounced kingdom, I've renounced this. Yes, but there's something that you have not renounced. Well, I'll burn down my hut. I'll give up my this. I'll burn down my clothes. And still the ego is there. She's trying to get him to gradually see, until this is renounced, nothing is renounced, because really all of that is not yours. The only thing that we have is our ego. All the other stuff is not ours. It's out there. You may think it's ours, but it's not ours. It was somebody else's yesterday, and guess what? It'll be somebody else's tomorrow. But we're stuck with our own baggage, with our own ego, with our own misunderstandings. That came with us, that has been perpetuated further with us in this life, that will go with us. That we can work on. So by assuring I have nothing to do with anyone, nor anything to do with me, it doesn't mean we hate them. It simply realizes we let things be. We let people be who they are. That giving them more room and space is love. Disallowing them is suffocation and non-love. So actually, this non-attachment furthers love that is experienced, because it increases tolerance. It increases acceptance. Whatever happens is because of past karma. However things work out, whether people reject here, there, or because of divine will or whatever, what have I to do with it? I am to do with supporting my aspiration of what I think is truly good. So pursuit of pleasure is pursuit of increase or dire disease. Prosperity is calamity. Meetings are only for parting, and time is all devouring. It waits, time and tide wait for no one. So the seeker makes up a basic school of thought for himself, and this forms his or her protection while they are going through this change and the turbulence. The turbulence is always when you make changes in the outer, in the inner. Sorry. The outer does not correspond with the inner. And this is the conflict that we experience in spiritual life. Unless one has some kind of protection of a school of thought, one doesn't get to go through this passage where everything falls in place once again. Everything's in place in our life because we have sort of, the inner has accepted the outer and they're sort of in sync. When we move to polish the inner, the outer does not harmonize with the inner school of thought, and there is conflict. We need an inner sort of school of thought to hold on to while this turbulence goes through its, I will call, leveling. So ordinary non-attachment can be furthered or enhanced by a couple things. The company of holy ones, people that have walked this path before. Two, avoiding the company or contact with all that is not supportive of one's aspiration and sustaining self-awareness. And three, by intense self-effort. This has to be ongoing all the time, real time. So by all this, one gains correct understanding of the truth concerning everything. When this correct understanding of the truth comes about, it's also called, or what it also brings, is the state called superior non-attachment. We talked about ordinary, which is supported by a school of thought. Superior is supported by a direct experience. This is the difference between the two. One who has directly realized the truth can ascertain, I am not the doer. The doer is either past karma or divine will. One can only know that and say that and feel that when one has directly experienced the truth. Till one comes to this level, one has to function supported by a school of thought, which is the very heart of the teachings that one has inculcated or internalized or made oneself. Only when one crosses that can one come to this other thing. When you come to the superior non-attachment, there is no division between inside and outside, substantiality and insubstantiality, inertia, consciousness, appearance, non-appearance, all of this stuff. Real wisdom is there in the heart, which is a result, not of study, but of one's direct experience. So this is the big difference between the two types of attachment that we have talked about. Friends, let us summarize the important points that we have discussed today. Today, we discuss the third of the seven states or planes of wisdom called Tanumanasi, or the thinned and weakened mind. Towards this, we also talked about the characteristics of one in this state and four ways, broad ways, towards which we can make this happen that also provide depth towards understanding. One assimilates the teachings of the scriptures, lives with the masters, and listens to their teachings. We also spoke about an indirect way of living with the masters by living with their teachings. Two, being indifferent to this world, which is not hatred, indifferent. One leads a very disciplined life, away from society and completely free from all contact. This away may be internal awareness till external awareness may come about. Three, practice of the teachings, which results in a right perception of what is. And four, the spirit of non-attachment of both types increases. Next time, we continue with the seven states or planes of wisdom by discussing the fourth state, Sattvapatti, or the natural turning away from sense pleasure and dwelling in truth. Friends, thank you for joining me today. To download this video, its audio, or PDF handout, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.